Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from appellant at City of Dallas versus Interstate Contracting Corporation.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles S. Reed, represent argument from the appellant. Appellant has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case is submitted to this court based on certified questions from the Fifth Circuit. The basic facts in that case involved the city contracting with ICC for the construction of levees and lakes at a sewage treatment plant. ICC, in turn, contracted with MSI, subcontracted with MSI. A dispute arose over who was responsible for subsurface conditions and the additional costs that resulted from those subsurface conditions. The city took the position that the contract shifted that burden onto the contractor. And refused to pay any additional costs. It did pay the full contract price. ICC and MSI entered into a prosecution agreement where the contractor essentially transferred the use of its name to the subcontractor. The subcontractor then prosecuted this lawsuit against the city.
I don't understand this pass-through issue at all. Does the contractor have a claim against the city or not?
As I understand, yes, it was tied to additional costs resulting to the subcontractor. It was a component
And so, irrespective of what body is sitting over there, if you win on the fact that the city does not owe the contractor any further money, the case goes away.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, essentially, as the...
But if you lose on your, if the jury concludes or the judge concludes that yes, under your agreement with the contractor, you owe the contractor more money, then the city loses. In this case.
No, Your Honor. We have at least in this circuit additional reasons why we're not responsible, assuming that this was a claim truly brought by a contractor.
Well, that's what I don't understand about this. The only way whoever that body is that's suing the city can win is if they prove the contractor has a claim against the city. That's the only way they can win, right?
Correct.
And if you prove or if you establish that the contractor has no claim against the city, then the city wins in this case.
Correct.
And it doesn't really matter what body is in that chair over there. You're litigating whether or not you owe the contractor any more money. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
So, again, I don't understand the pass-through argument. Whether if the contractor says, you know, I'm not going to litigate whether or not I've got a claim over there, but if you want to litigate whether or not I have a claim over there, you're free to go fight this out. As far as the jury is concerned, it's you against the contract against the city, and you win or lose depending on whether...
But that's not really what happened, Your Honor. It turned out to be the city against the subcontractor, not the city against the contractor. We didn't enter into a contract with the subcontractor. We entered into agreement with the contractor. We didn't have the contractor present at trial.
And you say that you're immune from suit by the contractor on its own claim?
I believe that under the current law that is evolving with sovereign immunity here, there has not been a waiver of immunity from suit as to the contract. That issue is still before the court in other matters, but the soon be sued clauses.
Is that issue in the Riata construction case?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Nobody cites that case, or something?
Yes, I believe I did, Your Honor.
I didn't see it.
Sorry, but it is in there as well as the Ebar case that is. It's also before the court.
So it would be your position that for the city to be sued on its contract, you have to go to the state legislature for them to decide whether or not the city can be sued on the contract?
As I understand, that's what this court has held, is that the decision of whether or not a governmental entity can be held liable or have its immunity from suit waived depends upon the legislature. And I understand that there is...
A dispute about that.
There is a dispute about that issue, but... the question as to sovereign immunity, even if your view is correct, by entering into a contract, there has been a waiver. That waiver should be limited in scope to the party we contracted with. and not to anyone else. And that goes back to what you were talking about earlier, is that we are in dispute with the subcontractor, not the contractor.
Do we really need to reach, or do we reach immunity from suit under the questions that were certified for review here?
Well, I don't believe you need to reach those issues because I believe privity standing answer those questions before you ever need to get to that issue. If you're going to approve a pass-through claim, I think you have to reach those issues.
Why shouldn't the Fifth Circuit just reach those issues? They didn't ask us, they didn't ask us that third question. Assuming that you reach that, that please decide immunity.
Well, what they did ask, though, is are pass-throughs allowed under Texas law? And I think since this is a governmental entity involved, I don't see how you cannot reach that issue if you're going to permit a pass-through claim, because what we're talking about is the subcontractor, in effect, bringing the claim against the city, and we have not made a waiver either by entering into a contract with the subcontractor.
We would be in a minority of jurisdictions if we were not to recognize a pass-through claim. So why shouldn't we join the majority? The great trend is the other way, it seems like.
Well, a couple of reasons. One is, as I understand, there are 19 cases, 19 states that have reached the issue. I mean, they've talked about the issue. Three never made a decision. Three, at least in part or completely, have refused to recognize it. And that you have the rest that have varying degrees of it. Texas is unique in the way that it treats privity, in the way it treats standing, sovereign immunity, and most critically here is how it treats partial settlements. Because that's what, in effect, we're talking about here.
Let me put aside the sovereign immunity question. It's my understanding you're saying that the contractor could bring the entire amount of this claim against the city.
If it had sustained those damages. It has not sustained those damages. Because what it is doing, as the certified question was, it's bringing this claim on behalf of the subcontractor. It's not bringing it as its own damages. It's saying we're not liable on our own to the subcontractor. It is like, in a lot of ways, this pass-through component is like an agreed judgment and agreeing not to execute on that judgment.
Well, but what if the subcontractor has just not been paid? And I realize these are overruns that are being disputed, but what if this was just the regular contract price that the owner was withholding? The contractor could bring that claim saying, we're entitled to payment.
If the contractor had not been paid, it could bring those claims because it would be a breach of its contract relating to its own damages. We're not talking about the contractor's damages. We're talking about the subcontractor's damages. And the city did not enter into the contract with the subcontractor.
Let me see if I understand that. Apart from immunity, if the subcontractor had sued the contractor and obtained a judgment, on the theory that it has, theory that was asserted in this case, and the contractor had then sued the city, if apart from immunity, the contractor could recover against the city on that theory.
Conceivably, yes, Your Honor.
The argument is, why make a two-step process out of it?
Well, because, and this goes back to this court's treatment of partial settlements, is that you run the risk of two parties agreeing who is responsible. You don't have a fair adjudication of all the facts. In our setting, the subcontractor was involved in the pre-bid investigation. We believe that he did an inadequate job given that the contract provided that all risk of subsurface conditions were placed on them. In a true setting, like what you described, when you have all three parties, well, the contractor naturally would have asserted the failure to do an adequate investigation as part of its defense. Contractor itself has a clause that it doesn't have to pay unless it's paid. It would have asserted that defense against the subcontractor. Instead, they've essentially passed the claim through, said the contractor is wholly innocent. Well, that's one of the problems with that, is that it's an assumption by the contractor and the subcontractor as to who's responsible, and they're seeking to shift that full responsibility up to the owner.
But the city can raise that as a part of its defense against the contractor, can it? I mean, and against the subcontractor.
Yes, Your Honor, but in our situation, we have the contractor in name appearing, and its representative was the subcontractor's president. you were not going to have a full and candid exchange of information and evidence and points of view, as well as offenses, when the contractor and the subcontractor are essentially merged as one.
As a matter of public policy, is your we talked about this in other cases. Isn't your argument really that as a matter of public policy, a contractor cannot permit its name to be used by the real party who's harmed to bring a claim under its contract against the city? Just as a matter of public policy, we're just not going to allow a contractor to allow give permission to the sub to go against the owner to litigate these very issues.
I think that, I mean, that is one of the components, and that is a real fundamental problem with allowing the use of the name to let someone else prosecute a claim that they otherwise couldn't prosecute on their own.
So in this case, the subcontractor would have no remedy?
No, Your Honor. He could pursue performance bonds, payment bonds, which may or may not be adequate, but that's a remedy that the legislature has.
But, I mean,
decided.
We have no remedy in court against anyone.
No, they could pursue the contractor.
Well, but if the theory of the case is that the owner misrepresented the soil conditions, they don't have a suit against the contractor. So if the city had, had misrepresented something that the subcontractor relied on, under your theory, they would have no judicial remedy.
Well, the first problem would be that the city wouldn't be making representations to the subcontractor since it wasn't dealing with the subcontractor. It was entering into a contract with the contractor, and that's who would be dealing with and making any kind of representations or warranties.
So then the contractor could sue for misrepresentation?
Yes, if it had sustained the damages. The question is, in part, you know, should this type of situation, a contracting situation, be treated differently than any other situation in which three parties are involved? And I don't believe that they should. I mean, because in Mary Carter's situation or State Farm versus Gandy situation where you have three parties and you have two of them that essentially allocate the responsibility and try to shift it to a third, the public policy should be against allowing that because it has a tendency to distort it.
How do you square that with our jurisprudence that says claims are freely assignable? I mean, the contractor here could have assigned its claim to the subcontractor, couldn't it?
Presumably it could have, then the contractor would be still asserting the claims of the subcontractor, not its own claims. And that's the problem, is that the sub has no claims that are directly against the owner or the city, because there is a lack of privity. And, of course, they're denying there was any type of assignment that this type.
But, well, you're saying lack of privity. But the truth is that for the subcontractor to win, they can't say it's their damages. They have to say that it's damages of the contractor under their agreement with the city. If you establish that the contractor suffered no damages as a result of any conduct of the city, then the sub loses. Don't they? I mean, the sub can't walk in and say, well, I suffered these damages, and they have to show that you had an obligation to the contractor that you breached. It seems to me you win on your point. It has nothing to do with privity. You win on your point if, in fact, you have no obligation to the contractor that you've breached in this circumstance, and you win.
Correct.
It seems to me privity is not the... I mean, it's not the sub can't win by claiming, hey, we were harmed by some sort of obligation.
Well, that's sort of why we're here, Your Honor, is we are talking about the subcontractor's damages that have been asserted against the city. And they have prevailed today. And we have been defending against the subcontractor's claims, not the contractor's claims.
So if the subcontractor had sued the contractor, and the contractor's defense was, we made no misrepresentations. We relied on the city's judgment for contractor, subs out, even though the city made a misrepresentation.
No, Your Honor, because I think that the contractor in that situation can assert,
you just posited the scenario that if the contractor were in there, the contractor could have defended saying no misrepresentation. We didn't misrepresent anything. We're privity. We contractor didn't misrepresent anything. We relied on what the city told us. We're not liable. So subcontractor gets zeroed out against contractor. Because there's no privity, they have no relief against the misrepresenter.
Well, Your Honor, I guess this goes back to the what I originally said is that we wouldn't be misrepresenting anything to the subcontractor to begin with because we're not contracting with them.
So no remedy.
Well, there shouldn't be any cost because we're not contracting with them. We wouldn't have been making a representation and warranty to the subcontractor. It would have been to the contractor. And so if there are damages, it should be the contractor's damages and not the subcontractor.
Well, even though the contractor didn't make the misrepresentation. I mean, you just said their whole defense is we made no misrepresentation. And they didn't.
Well, then I'm not, I guess, I have trouble with the factual scenario because what is the subcontractor's harm or claim or misrepresentation?
Well, if the city misrepresented soil conditions, I mean, let's just say that there was some misrepresentation by the city. A subcontractor could never recover for that because the general's going to say, we didn't make the misrepresentation. We're not liable. Subcontractor can't sue the city. So if they have cost overruns or relied on something like that, they're just out without a remedy.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, unless we want to overrule privity and some other standing requirements, or unless the legislature provides a better remedy, yes, they may be without a remedy. But I don't think that's true scenario of what would likely happen because any of the representations are going to be between the contractor and the subcontractor.
Well, but can't we, I mean, we know that in these days when there's a construction project of this magnitude, there are going to be subcontractors that are retained to do much of the work. So, I mean, it's conceivable that a representation from the city about soil conditions to the general contractor is going to be repeated to all the subcontractors, and the contractor going to be made in reliance on that initial representation if it's a critical one. Isn't that right? I mean, we know it's going to be passed through, so to speak. That representation will.
Right, but it's not, I mean, I guess there is the possibility that those kind of things could get conveyed on down the line, but it still goes back to who has the city elected to contract with, and that is the contractor. We're looking to one person to be responsible to, and look to be responsible to only one other person, not to the myriad of subcontractors that may or may not be involved.
So would you say that this contract between the sub and the general contractor is just void? I mean, they can't have a contract to prosecute a claim. The law just doesn't recognize that sort of contract or agreement.
If you're talking about the prosecution agreement?
Yes.
Yes, I believe that it flies in the face of...
The law just doesn't recognize it. It's a nullity.
It should not be recognized, at least under the treatment of Mary Carter agreements and similar type of settlement agreements that represent a partial settlement as opposed to that if encouraged further litigation.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from Appellate.
May I please support Mr. Steve Miller, who is an argument for the appellate.
Mr. Miller.
Yes, Your Honor.
Looking at the appellant's brief, the city's brief, page 3, it says that the contract between ICC and the city barred ICC assignment or conveyance of any interest in the contract. So the ICC was solely responsible for paying subcontractors. And it says any subcontractor has no rights created in its favor against the city. Why doesn't that end the case? We've been talking about common law. Let's look specifically at the terms of this contract.
Sure.
Why don't those provisions completely answer the question?
I'm going to answer that question, but I'm going to note at the outset that that is not a certified issue before this court. The Fifth Circuit has all the issues that are going to decide the merits. There are 26 of those. The sole issue before the court relates to the pass-through claim. But the answer to your question is that in a pass-through claim, it is not an assignment. You are correct that there is an anti-assignment provision in the owner's contract. If you look at the restatement of contracts, it says that an assignment is a complete transfer of the assignor's rights to performance by the obligor, and that's extinguished. In this case, if that was true, then Interstate could not have appeared in federal court. Their name could not have appeared in the pleadings. They couldn't have been a party because they would have completely assigned their rights to someone else. In addition, the whole notion of pass-through claims that's developed in the federal system has been developed in a context where federal law also has a very strict anti-assignment provision under federal law. pass-through claims have already been distinguished as federal law as not being assignments.
Practically, what's the difference?
Well, the difference, Your Honor, is if there was an assignment, the lawsuit would have been brought in the name of Mine Service. Mine Service would have been subject ostensibly to a counterclaim from the city. They would have been liable to the court under Rule 11. They would have been the party that would have gotten judgment in their favor. They would have had the right to execute on the judgment, the right to accept money. Instead, we have a situation where throughout this...
Actually, that's all what's happened here.
No.
They're the ones that are running the case. It's their witness in the chair. And they're going to get the money.
In a pass-through arrangement, who finances it can be decided among the parties. Who hires the lawyer? Who hires the expert? What strategies employed? Who sits at counsel table? ICC could have had anyone there. They could have had his mother there, the president of the corporation. They chose to have one of the principal witnesses sit as the corporate representative. But the reality is, at the end of the day, the only party that will get the judgment is Interstate. The only party
they're not going to keep the money, sure.
Well, but the only reason they're not going to is because they have an underlying liability, the pass-through claim. They have an obligation to pay that on to Mine Service. That liability is exactly the point of the pass-through claim. That liability has never been extinguished.
I'm just trying to understand practically what's the difference. I mean, is there any practical difference between, I understand the legal differences, but is there any practical difference between what happens with a signed claim and what happens with a pass-through claim?
Well, I think the practicalities are who does the money go to, and that Interstate could choose to breach the agreement and not give it to Mine Service. They do ultimately have responsibility as a practical matter for appearing in court.
But if everybody does what they're supposed to do, there's no difference.
Well, the pass-through claim is designed to provide certain economies and to allow the party that suffered the damages to be able to present that easily, to have economies in the judiciary of having one lawsuit. And so, yes, it does look in many respects like an assignment because it has the same features, that is, of economy.
The claims presentation,
it's not the same.
The claims presentation and prosecution agreement, I'll call the pass-through agreement, what actually did it convey from ICC to MCI?
It conveyed an agreement that specified the methods of cooperation in the prosecution of the claim that was going to occur not through a name. It occurred through a corporate entity, and it provided...
What were these methods that were conveyed?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You're talking generally, I understand that. What specifically was conveyed? ICC would be at trial, but MCI would control the trial strategy, the witnesses, hire the attorneys. What else was conveyed?
It provided who was going to control the trial strategy, correct, who was going to pay for that. It provided how the money would be split up at the end. It provided who would have charge of any settlement. In this, lots of times the subcontractor has full discretion to settle. In this particular instance, it required the consent of both ICC and the subcontractor.
How was the money to be split? All of it to MCI?
No, Your Honor. ICC would get all of their extended performance costs, the damages that they put on, which is about $250,000 in damages we put on, plus they get their 15 their portion, pro rata portion of the 15% markup.
Okay, so of the $1.8 million under your pass-through agreement, how would the money be split roughly? Do you know? Have you done that calculation?
I have done that calculation. It's around $200,000 probably. But this is, in terms of, it makes no difference whether the general contractor receives $0 at the end of it. In this particular instance, they will get some.
If there weren't pass-through,
yes, sir.
The subcontractor would have to sue the contractor.
Correct.
And say that, which I take it is true in this case, that the statements made by the owner were repeated by the contractor. Statements made by the owner to the contractor were repeated by the contractor to the subcontractor. Those are false, breach, whatever. So we're suing you, and the contractor is going to be inclined in that suit to say, no, we're not liable. And if they got tagged, they would turn around and, would turn around and sue the owner, essentially the same claim, saying, you owe us for what we owe him.
Correct.
And this just collapses that.
Correct.
And so it seems to me practically to come down to whose side is the contractor going to be on going in? Is it going to be on the owner's side, or is it going to be on the subcontractor's side?
Presumably the contractor makes that decision based on his contract obligations and the perceived liability.
But if you're getting sued, his inclination is going to be on the owner's side. Nobody did nothing. And if it's a pass-through, his inclination is going to be on the subcontractor side. This guy over here did it to both of us. Is that practically what it comes down to?
Well, it may be, Your Honor, but for instance, the general contractor always faces the danger that there's going to be a counterclaim filed against them. So he may not be in a position, you know, if he doesn't think that there's merit to the subcontractor's claim, he's not going to enter into an agreement. He's going to say, I'm going to stop it here. I'm not going forward with it. In this instance, he evaluated it and agreed completely that it was to be the owner's responsibility and went forward with the action.
So part of the dynamic of this is to hopefully insert the contractor's own independent analysis of the ultimate harm in the litigation, because the contractor has something at risk as well.
It does. And what we have to remember is that the only thing that was tried to this jury was the contract between the city and ICC. The jury instructions came out of that contract. The damages flowed out of that contract. There wasn't any other contract that was litigated except that one.
And if the contractor had made independent misrepresentations to the subcontractor, there are no pass-through claims for that, just to be clear.
Correct. I mean, the general contractor would have liability directly to the subcontractor.
That he could not turn around and recover from the
order. Correct. And presumably, the subcontractor is going to analyze that, and if the real perpetrator of the wrong is the general contractor, they're not going to enter into a situation where they would go against the owner, because the owner would have a defense that there was an intervening cause. That it was the general contractor that caused it.
Everybody's got a theory on why this hasn't come up before. Do Texas contractors not use pass-through arrangements?
No.
You say it is so routine that everybody can assume this was the law.
Yeah. I practice construction law by background. I've addressed this issue in the Missouri Supreme Court. I would bet that if you brought members of the Texas Construction Bar up here and you asked them before this question was certified, are pass-through claims allowed in Texas, every one of them would say, yes, I use it every day. And if you'd ask them why, they would say that there's a 60-year history of jurisprudence in the federal courts that's well-developed that give all of us that practice in this area guidelines. That we have a 60-year history of it providing reliable, effective, efficient, and equitable resolution.
Well, in fact, and of course, I venture to say we're all fairly new with this concept.
Correct.
You can probably tell that from our questioning, but it seems to me it would be more beneficial to owners in the long run, because they have the contractor as a buffer, and it's only if the contractor is going to want to maybe agree with the owner, because that's where their interests lie in selling their services to the people who are going to contract them on that basis. They're the buffer to determine whether the subcontractor's claim is good or not. So, to the extent there's a tendency, it's going to be maybe to side with the owner more, or is that wrong? Because it does put a lot of discretion in the contractor. If they don't agree with the subcontractor's claim, the subcontractor's just out. Right?
Well, that's true. They have their own contract with the subcontractor, and they could resist the claim, and that does happen. But the point is that where you're in an instance where the wrong is being caused not by the general contractor, everybody clearly agrees it's from the owner's actions. And typically that's what's happening, because the owner is giving directions and ordering more work, et cetera. But in that situation, it allows the parties to efficiently litigate it. And again, what's being litigated is only the city's obligation. One of the questions that the Fifth Circuit asked of the city in oral argument was, tell us, how has the city been prejudiced? There was no answer really given at that point, and I haven't heard an answer since then. The reality is that the recovery in this case is limited by law exclusively to the terms of the city's contract with the contractor.
Well, but the prejudice is, it's the same prejudice we have in all these cases, that the fella in the middle will take sides that he wouldn't take otherwise, that the contractor will take the subcontractor's side, when if he were being sued himself, he wouldn't take that side. He'd say, there were no misrepresentations. It was your fault. You You should have done more testing on the soil. These are your problems. They're not my problems. They're not the city's problems. Whereas if there's a way to be in league with the other side, then your position changes. And that's what's troubled us in all of these cases.
But, Your Honor, it still comes down to a matter of law, is that at the end of the day, the only thing that can be recovered is what is due from the city under its contract. Okay, let's say that the general contractor has a natural inclination to side with the subcontractor and says, you know, this way I can avoid being sued. The reality is that the issue still has to be litigated. It still has to be a meritorious claim supported by evidence. There has to be a verdict, and there's going to be a review. So the city hasn't been prejudiced one instance. And I think, Judge O'Neill, I think you asked the question, what about the situation if the city had performed all of the work in this case? The city acknowledges that we wouldn't be here. It's just a matter of happenstance that this particular portion of work was given to a subcontractor. And what the city's saying is the gravamen of their suit is that you can't maintain this suit until you either pay all the money first to the contractor or you go off and litigate it separately. And that is contrary to existing Texas law. So you ask me what construction lawyers would say. We've cited to you four different cases from three different appellate divisions that all say that a general contractor does not have to first pay a subcontractor in order to recover on their behalf. And I would direct your attention to the Triton Oil case. I think it's well-reasoned, and in your own, when you're looking at what constitutes a pass-through claim under Texas law, look at the Triton Oil decision, because it comes right out of Texas law and says clearly that you don't have to make payment first. And that's what the city's... Yes, Your Honor.
You indicated that there was a law that limits the city's recovery to the terms of the contract. What law is that? Is that the constitutional provision that the city argued or some other
law? It's the law of the contract. I mean, the contract between the city and the general contractor establishes the law, and it's subject to those terms.
Are there cases in other jurisdictions where the courts have held, or in the federal arena or other states, where courts have held that notwithstanding contract provisions that may require or may preclude any conveyance of any interest from the contractor to the subcontractor, that notwithstanding any such terms, that pass-through agreements will be allowed?
You're going back to the anti-assignment. Is that what you're talking about, John?
Yes. Well, that's part of it.
The important thing is the anti-assignment, again, is not applicable because
assume it is.
Okay. Well, it's difficult to assume that because the primary contractual relationship is defined by the subcontract. This isn't a situation where you have a third party and you're giving an assignment to them. The reason that the subcontractor ultimately gets paid under a pass-through claim is because there's an underlying obligation that was established by the subcontract to begin with. Indeed, and I think this is important for you to realize that you may not be familiar with the construction industry. The way the construction industry works, unlike many other industries, is that when it comes time to be paid each month, the subcontractor gives his pay request to the general contractor. And a number of them may come in. The general contractor bundles those together and gives them to the owner. The owner then passes money. This is why it's called pass-through. It means it's passing the money through. The money then goes to the general contractor, who in turn distributes it to the subcontractors. Similarly, if there's a change order, if the subcontractor believes they're being required to do extra work, the way they do it is they pass it up the line. They send it to the general contractor. The general contractor gives it to the owner. The owner makes a reply, and the general contractor puts it back to them. Same thing with the claims process. The claim goes to the general contractor, on to the owner, and back down. It's what happens in the courtroom isn't any different than what's happening throughout the contractual relationship during the administration of the contract. And that's the beauty of it. It just mirrors the contractual realities that already exist.
In other jurisdictions, suppose the owner just doesn't want that. He said, I want everybody to agree that that won't happen.
Then what won't happen, John?
I don't want to be subject to a pass-through claim. I just want to negotiate that. I want everybody to sit down and I just want to negotiate that won't be the case. Can that be done in jurisdictions that allow pass-through claims?
I don't believe so, because it extinguishes the general contractor's right. If you look at the Blair decision out of the U.S. Supreme Court, very significant, and I would again urge you to look at that. It talks about, in this situation, the contractor's right to recover. The contractor's right to recover. And in your situation, the owner essentially would be asking in advance somehow for the general contractor to release or abrogate the right to recover for the value of what's been given.
No, I just say, I don't want you, what I don't want to have happen is, I don't want you suing me on some obligation you say is due a subcontractor. Against you order in your agreement.
Now, your parties can agree to a lot in a contract. That's why I hesitate, Your Honor.
A lot of litigation about, are you really on the hook? How far do you have to go before you really, there really is some obligation to the subcontractor? And all I'm saying is, can the owner agree with the general contractor ahead of time? It's got to be a judgment.
You might be able to do that. I'd have to think through that. But the other reality is in the construction industry, the owner has a clause in there that requires the general contractor to pay the subcontractors for the work, services, labor, and equipment. Indeed, it's usually an indemnification provision. And in this underlying contract, they had to certify every month that they were paying those subcontractors for the amount that was due them. So it would be, it'd be very strange for the owner at the same time to be saying, we don't want to be responsible for paying the subcontractor.
Well, let me ask you a question. I'm having difficulty. I mean, I understand where you get this notion of pass-through, and that's what cases talk about it, but I'm having a hard time understanding what this pass-through means. You got ICC. ICC has a contract with the city. There are people out there who think that contract's been breached. Forget about it being a sub. There are just people out there who think it's been breached. ICC says, I don't know whether it's been breached or not. But I will let you, Bill Smith, if you want to spend the money to litigate this deal, you can do it in my name. And when we get a judgment, it's going to be an ICC. And Bill says, I agree with you. I agree with you that I'm going to put my money in this, but the only thing that's going to happen when we get the deal is either I prove that there's a breach and the damages, and the money goes to your name. And you say, fine. Is that a pact? I mean, can we craft a rule that would prohibit ICC for any claim it ever had from simply agreeing with XYZ that they'll be the ones that can bring the claim on their behalf? I mean, you're a lawyer hired. I mean, can we say, ICC, you can't hire that lawyer because that lawyer really works for somebody else, not ICC? I mean, if ICC has a claim, then what interest is it of the courts to look behind ICC's claim to see why ICC is bringing the claim?
I couldn't agree more, you know. That's why I said that the whole question, again, going back to Blair, is, what was the contractor's right to recover under the contract? That's what got litigated. What happened behind the scenes as to how that occurred, who shared in the cost, you know, who was going to get what, that's all a matter of contract between the general sub and the subcontractor that has nothing to do with the city. It has nothing to do with what was litigated. I couldn't agree with you more. In pass-through claims, you don't get behind that. If you look, you know, one of the issues you're asked to address is, if we're going to articulate under Texas law, what is a pass-through claim? How would we do that? And I'm going to encourage you to look in particular not only at the Blair decision, but also to look at the S.L. Jenkins decision. And I think it articulates it very well. I'm sorry, J.L. Simmons' decision, 1962, out of the U.S. Claims Court. And what it talks about, it focuses on here, is this issue of liability. But it basically says, then obviously we can say that where there's been a complete exoneration under the law, that the damage that's been complained of cannot be sought. There's been a complete exoneration. Goes on to say, kind of on the other end of the spectrum, suppose nothing is said in the subcontract. They said in that instance, there will still be an underlying liability because the basic nature of the relationship is that contractors are supposed to place subcontractors for the work they've done. Then they talk about what's the middle ground. And the middle ground is what you see most often in the pass-through claim, and that's been fashioned now over 40 years, really coming out of the J.L. Simmons case, and that is, for those of us that fashion pass-through agreements, we say that the underlying liability remains, that if there's a claim brought, the general contractor has a continuing obligation. Once they brought that claim, they have a continuing obligation to pay whatever monies are received onto the subcontractor. And J.L. Simmons provides a very good discussion of the law in that area that I would encourage Texas to adopt because it's proven the test of time. And what it says is that there is an implicit recognition of liability when parties enter into these liquidating agreement, that one of the ways that the general contractor is extinguishing its liability to the subcontractor is by going forward in this manner. And so we have a continuing liability that's there. And I think it'll provide very good guidance to you. If I were to be fashioning this for the Texas Supreme Court, I would go back and I would look at Blair coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court. And I would look at the Triton Oil decision out of the Texas Court of Appeals that says, contrary to the city's position, you don't have to pay a subcontractor in order to bring a claim for costs or damages that they've incurred. And then I would look to the J.L. Simmons case that discusses what liability must there still be between the general contractor and the subcontractor. And that case basically says... I'm sorry.
You've done real well without having a period to send it over.
I do have one last question.
I'll try to use periods.
And that is, isn't immunity, sovereign immunity, implicated in a situation like this, where it wouldn't be, obviously, if they weren't a governmental entity, because the subcontractor, the immunity issue might be different with regards suit by the contractor than it is by the subcontractor?
Again, that's not the issue before the court, but the answer to the question is that the sovereign immunity is not implicated at all in this because, the claim occurs precisely within the confines of the underlying contract between the city. And if the law is that there is a limited waiver of sovereign immunity, the city waives its sovereign immunity when it entered into this contract with the contractor. The pass-through that's occurring all occurs within that contract. There isn't, as I said before, how has the city been damaged? Its liability has not been enhanced one iota. The only damages that a jury could render against it were damages under the contract, which were all foreseeable at the time and contemplated by the contractor. If you look at the Triton Oil decision, it says that in the construction industry, everyone knows, the owners know, that there are going to be all kinds of collateral contracts. And they even fashion it that way with subcontractors. And so there's no instance where you've got a subcontractor that's making an end run around a general contractor that might implicate sovereign immunity. I know this is a hot issue with the court. I don't think it's implicated at all in this instance. I will also tell you that it was not preserved at the trial court level, and it is not an issue before the Fifth Circuit in this case.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a question. Suppose ICC used their own lawyers and spent their own money to prosecute the claim against the city. Could the city come in and say, well, really they're doing it on behalf of a subcontractor and we're not privy to subcontractor? Could you win on that argument?
I believe we would, Your Honor, if they don't have independent liability or responsibility to the subcontractor because it's not their damages. And that's part
of
this.
You could prove it wasn't their damages because you'd say this is simply a pass-through. I mean, I know the contractor, we paid the contractor his 15% markup, and all of this is just what the subcontractor incurred in doing the job. And so we look behind what the contractor's suing for, and what they're really suing for is what the subcontractor charged on this job, and we have no agreement with them, so we have no liability.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's not different than what happens whenever a party is asserting damages that they have themselves have not sustained, and that's what we're talking about. Is that we contracted with ICC, they did not sustain the damages, and they never will sustain the damages. They're bringing it strictly on behalf, as the question was certified, on behalf of the subcontractor.
So under your agreement with the contractor, the contractor comes in and says, I'll build this building for you. You say yes, and the contractor says, I'll do a 15% markup upon on top of the actual cost, and you say, that's fine. And so they come and they give you the actual cost, and you say, well, here's your 15% markup, and now where's our completed building? And you cannot be sued for any of the actual cost of construction if it was done by a subcontractor.
Only, we could be if the contractor themselves, if the contractor itself is liable for those costs to the subcontractor. Otherwise, it is not sustaining that interest.
I think it's been made clear, but that would not arise until there is a judgment against the contractor in the litigation between the sub and the general.
Or in the situation where they have, in fact, paid them.
Once that liability is established that way, there's got to be payment or a judgment so that they're a judgment debtor. Only in those circumstances do you say they could then sue the city to recover.
Yes, Your Honor. And what they were talking about earlier is complaining about this payment requirement, but in the setting of equitable contribution to the extent it exists anymore, equitable subrogation, equitable indemnity, payment is required until that party can pursue against the other person to bring a claim. So the payment requirement is already out there. This would be an anomaly to a payment requirement. A couple of questions were asked about the non-payment clause. First, partial assignments, at least as I understand, are permissible. So whatever this use of the name is, was permissible. And I don't know, the value of the transferring the use of the name is a right. And if it's not an assignment, I don't know what it is. Because then I think you can take any Mary Carter agreement and say, I'm not assigning my rights, I'm just going to assign the use of the name. The one case that there is that deals with a non-assignment clause and a pass-through that involved the use of the name is out of Rhode Island, it's Infinity Construction, and they said it was prohibited by that clause, and it's the only case that I know that treats that issue. One of the concerns was about the possibility of flows, pass-throughs. It seems to me they could flow both ways, and I think some of the questions were concerned about the contractor being in a situation where it could be the highest bidder, because the owner could make the same kind of agreement with the contractor to pursue claims in the name of the contractor against the sub. I think that just goes to show the inherent risk of allowing two parties to make some type of agreement to pursue the third. A couple of questions regarding prejudice, and I think we were talking about misrepresentations made to the subcontract by the contractor or representations made to the sub. That's what we're defending. We may not have made those representations that are being asserted. And the central problem with prejudice is we're defending against an action and against a person we did not enter into a contract with.
But the judgment in this case against you is on representations you made, found by the jury.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, based on the plans and specifications, our position, of course, is contrary to the terms of the contract. Bottom line of this is, one other point was, why hasn't this issue come up before? And I think part of that is this court's treatment of partial settlements is contrary to those states that allow pass-throughs. They view partial settlements, even though they guarantee additional litigation, as a valid policy reason, and this state does not. And also, historically, this court has always, the courts of appeals have always said, the subcontractor looks to the contractor, and the contractor looks to the owner.
Is it true that in the contract there is a provision that in which you require the general to pay the subs and to confirm that payment?
Yes, and in fact, that would seem to support the claim that a sub could bring a claim against the contractor based on that provision, because it should be incorporated as well.
And then the invoices go from the subcontractor through the general, and then on the subcontractor's behalf, the general submits the payment invoice, accumulates them all, submits them to the owner.
It depends on the situation. Usually there are progress payments,
the general is collecting the money from the owner and then distributes it to everybody else, just like they collect the invoices and then accumulate those at some point and submit them to the it's kind of like this. I mean, it does mirror their contention that there's a pass-through claim.
Well, no, Your Honor, because what we do is we pay essentially as it goes progress payments based on the completion of the project to date. And that's how it's framed, and the invoices are based on what the progress.
But the general is sort of stepping into the shoes of the subs and as the facilitator for the payments for work that's done. And now they're stepping into the shoe of the sub to prosecute that same sort of claim.
Well, but the difference is, Your Honor, is that they have the contract between the contractor and subcontractor. That's their arrangement. That's not the city's arrangement. That's their agreement. And it shouldn't be shifted up onto the city because we did not enter into an agreement with any of these subcontractors.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in this case and for the day. That the marshal will adjourn the court.
All right.